Hey there, foreigners! This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the Ambitious Immigrants. Today's guest is Mark Fleischmann. Mark is from Germany, where he was born and brought up. He was inspired very early by Silicon Valley and its culture, and eventually moved to the Bay Area in the 90s. Mark is a serial entrepreneur who founded several companies, and his latest one being Deterra, for which he is the CEO and co-founder. In today's interview, Mark is going to talk about Transmeta, which is a company best known for giving Intel the run for its money in the early 2000s. Mark was an early employee and executive at Transmeta. Mark, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Hey, Roy, thank you so much for having me.
In the intro, I mentioned you are a serial entrepreneur, right? So I'm curious to know, it's an excruciating journey doing a startup, and what motivates you to keep coming back to it?
That's a really good question. I think you have to have a certain, drive yourself, a certain willingness to shape the future and participate in it. And I guess also, and that goes back to immigrant roots, a certain insecurity that keeps you on your toes. I certainly got all of it, and that kind of leads me to trying to shape the things the way I like them over and over again when I see them in a shape that I and I hope other people don't like them that much.
Yeah. So when we talked earlier, right, and when you talk about this immigrant background which helped you, I was like, oh, there is no way. He's from Germany. Germany is like an affluent country. And I've recently been to Germany, like after we talked the first time, and I learned about some of the history and how after the Second World War, the attitude of the people has been like more conservative. So I'm curious to know, how did that upbringing impact you in your startup life?
Yeah, Germany is an affluent country. There's no question about it. However, it's also a conservative country with a long-standing industrial history. And, when I got involved in computers very early, and that was really exotic in Germany. People really did not understand at all the microcomputer movement back in the early 80s. And if you're a young guy and you have a little bit of an instinct for technology, that was very, very exciting. Yet you were faced again with industry, 1.0 or 2.0. Everyone focused on old-fashioned cars. Everyone focused on old-fashioned, mid-sized sort of machines. And there wasn't much of a technology affinity in the country. And frankly, I still would doubt that a little. Plus, there's not a lot of entrepreneurial instinct. And this is what bothered me most. If you sort of sense that driving yourself early on, and you like to, push the boundaries, so to speak, or push the borders, subject to our talk here, then in Germany, that's really difficult. And people look up on you with a certain mistrust. In the US, it's the opposite. That's what, especially here in Silicon Valley and the West Coast, what people, thrive upon, right? And that's a very different culture. And ultimately, that's why I felt like perhaps I'm a better fit over here than in Germany.
Yeah. So stepping back a little bit and going down to your old life, as I said, so at 13, you mentioned you read an article about Steve Jobs. Tell us about it and how it impacted you.
Can you repeat the question?
No, I said earlier you told me that at 13, you read an article in some magazine about Steve Jobs. Tell us about it.
I started computers pretty early. Programming when I was 11, and back then you had basically VAXes or micro VAXes, and then you had the Commodore PETs, if you remember those. I started on AEM-65 from Rockwell, which was a 512-byte single motherboard hex editor computer. And then I read an article in a newspaper about Steve Jobs and Apple, which was revolutionary. They had just launched the Apple II back then. And it started with the location where this article was written, and it said Palo Alto. And I don't know, I guess I connected a few dots in my brain, and I knew that was the place I wanted to be. So about 10 years later, that was the place where I was.
So when you first started playing with computers, so to say, There was not even internet back then, right? At 11 years of age when you first started fiddling with computers, was there internet or no?
No, there was no internet. There weren't even modems. That came, I would say, 5, 6 years later, that people really started using modems pretty broadly. So no, that was it was just a little programmable, rather simplistic devices back then. But you, I mean, the beauty though was, again, you had a piece of hardware that you could suddenly tell and instruct to do magical things, and that just seemed extremely promising back then.
Yeah, I remember writing my first code in the early 90s, slightly later in Lotus, I believe. And when I listed the 1000th prime number or something like that, it gave me so much happiness because I didn't know that was possible. I was a math geek early on, and doing it in a computer was a tremendous feeling, and I'm sure that was similar to you.
Yes. Again, they had the programmable HP Pocket Calculator, one of the first models. One of my teachers had that, and I just didn't understand the difference between hardware and software back then. And how can you tell this, supposedly pretty dumb piece of equipment to do things that are rather unexpected? And that just that fascination, I guess. That fascination has been with me ever since. And then, as I said, the place to really go about this in an entrepreneurial way seemed really much more the birth area of the personal computer revolution, or the microcomputer revolution, which was the Silicon, or is the Silicon Valley.
Tell us about the cash flow funded company that you started and sold in 92. That was before you ever moved to, before you set your first foot on Silicon Valley, right?
Yeah, that was again. I started programming pretty early, and then, frankly, back then, if you had some basic understanding what to do with computers, it was very easy to get a consulting job or a job as a programmer. I preferred consulting. I was still going to high school, and then IBM released a PC, and within, I would say, very few years, it became very apparent that there was a lot of money to be made in the clone business. I remember I sold my first clone computer for the same price that IBM was quoting my customer just for a hard disk replacement.
What is
So
a clone
you could,
computer?
it was a gold rush for a couple of years. And
What
although,
is what is a clone computer?
Oh, okay. I guess today all computers other than the original IBM computers could be called clone computers. Everything that was not IBM original, IBM invented the PC, right? So everything that was not IBM was called a clone computer back then, okay? So anything that looked like a PC but wasn't produced by IBM, even Compaq, frankly, the original one was called a computer, but there was a great business back to source them directly from Taiwan, and then build a business around them, selling them in Germany. And that's what I got into on top of the just programming consulting. And that was, as I said, it was a gold rush for a few years, but it also came to an end pretty quickly because there wasn't a very high barrier to entry. So that was the business I started originally while I was at high school. And then I sold it because at that time, towards the end of it, I discovered the internet. Now, that back then meant not the web, or it didn't mean the internet like we know it today. It really meant just the protocol, TCP/IP, and the tools around it. But you could still experience back then the unbelievable location transparency that the internet gave you. You could obviously access any computer around the world with the same very simple commands, and that was just very, very powerful. And that led me to believe that I should probably find a business that had more legs than just selling IBM clones. So
What did you sell
I
it
sold the
for?
company.
What did you sell it for?
Sorry? It wasn't as much money as you would sell it here in the United States. It was a lot less money. For someone who just barely had finished high school, it was a decent exit, but nothing to get super excited about.
Okay. I mean, as a high school student, just the act of selling is itself an achievement. I would say any money is great money that will probably partially fund your tuition, right? I was thinking when I was looking at your profile earlier, right? So you had a taste of like entrepreneurship and what it felt like. You built a company and sold it, and then you went back to HP to work as an engineer. Why did you do that? Like, why did you, in some sense, go back to being an employee from already being an entrepreneur?
Yeah, there's really two answers for that. One is a simple one. Obviously, coming over to the US, I had to get a work permit first. And frankly, although I always wanted to start another company or other companies here, it seemed pretty daring for a pretty young kid from Germany to just come over and jump into pretty cold water. So I figured maybe I should get a real job first for a while. So that's the short answer. The longer answer is actually also related to why I sold the company. It goes back to when I discovered the internet back then. So I was thinking, okay, clearly this is so powerful. This must be one of the next revolutions. And remember, that was like in 90 or 91. So I sold the company, I think, in 92, if I remember correctly, around that time. And I was thinking, okay, if the internet happens, naturally, where would it happen, right? It probably would happen in the Silicon Valley. So far, so good. And then I was trying to figure out, okay, where more precisely in the Silicon Valley it might happen. And so I was thinking, look, TCP/IP was an instrumental ingredient in Unix back then. There was no Linux, or at least it was the very early days of Linux, and Windows had no TCP/IP built in. And it didn't occur to me that you could build it in because Windows was so simplistic back then.
Yeah,
So I figured, okay, if the internet wins, Unix is going to win.
just for people who are not familiar with TCP/IP, it's like a language in which you write a protocol of the internet. Is that the fair way to
Yes,
put it?
it's the lingua franca of the internet. It's
Okay.
basically the protocol which packages data and reliably transmits it to just about any location on the planet.
Okay.
Okay? Again, with completely the same semantics, which means it's just phenomenally scalable. And that was the thing that left such a big impression on me back then. So then I figured, okay, so if the internet or TCP/IP wins, Unix will win. And if Unix wins, I looked around, okay, what company really win that game? And there were really only three big companies back then. There was Sun, obviously, there was Hewlett Packard, and there was IBM. And I thought, okay, it's probably going to be Hewlett Packard because what Hewlett Packard did in 91, they released their first single chip RISC implementation, microprocessor implementation, PA-RISC, and their performance was just out of this world. It was called the first. They had very, very powerful workstations back then that were very successful. So, okay, it's got to be Hewlett Packard. And then I took the intersection between Silicon Valley and Hewlett Packard, and that was in my mind HP Labs. Okay, so 2 years later, I had made it to HP Labs here in Palo Alto, where I where I wanted to go all my life before then. And so that was great. In 93, I had made that. And unfortunately, again, 2 years later, in 95, I discovered that yes, as I thought, the internet revolution was happening in the Valley, and it was happening everywhere except for in HP Labs. So I would say good idea, bad execution, that kind of thing.
What visa were you on when you moved to Palo Alto through HP?
I was on an L1 visa because I had been planning for that, and I had gotten while I was finished, while I, after I had sold my company, and I was finishing university in Germany. I had gotten a temporary work assignment at Hewlett Packard Germany, and that was for a little longer than a year, and that allowed me to actually get an L1 visa to transfer to HP Labs.
I see. So you mentioned earlier, I think you were applying for your L1 exactly on the first year or on the 366th day of being in HP or
Yes.
something like that, right?
I was applying for my L1 visa to transfer to HP Labs about at 1 year and 3 days of being in Germany.
And 1 year
and
is
then,
the minimum
so that
time
was
needed.
Like in 93 or 94. And then a couple of years later, when I had come to the conclusion that probably HP Labs was not the best spot to sort of pursue an entrepreneurial dream or a dream to really be at the forefront of the internet. I actually also was looking for my next job in a startup, literally the day I got the stamp in permanent residency stamp in my passport.
Wow. But movement within L1 visa is not possible, right? How did you, I guess you didn't move because you stuck around in HP till 98.
Exactly. I stuck around in HP until I had my exact, that's exactly right. Movement is not possible. So I stuck around in HP until, again, the day I got my, how is it called, adjustment of status to permanent resident. And
I
within
see.
2 weeks, I had the job.
I see. That explains. So I was like, why did you stick around from 95 to 98? In 98, when you decided to move out of HP, you moved to Transmeta, right? And you
That's
said
right.
you moved to Transmeta as a QA lead. But in the beginning, you didn't like the job as much. Tell us about those times.
Yeah, so that was another interesting one. HP Labs, I would say from a scientific and from a technology perspective, was a fantastic place. I do want to give them credit. It was an amazing place. And I learned for the rest of my life and for the rest of career a lot of skills there that would I would not have been able to do what I did without that time at HP Labs. They were way ahead on technology in many regards back then. As I said, unfortunately, it was just not obviously a place to really pursue startup dreams, and it was not the ideal place to really be at the forefront of the internet. So what happened afterwards, I was a member of technical staff at HP Labs, and Transmeta was one of the hottest companies, it was becoming one of the hottest companies back then in the early 90s. People like Linus Torvalds, the creator of Linux, for instance, were there. I was willing to take whatever job they would be willing to give me, and the job that they would be willing to give me wasn't even a QA lead, it was just a QA engineer. So I became a QA engineer. Mm-hmm. But, life is really, in hindsight, about connecting dots. I think Steve Jobs said that at some point, and it's so true. And this was one of those opportunities where only in hindsight you can see how valuable some of these experiences are, because as a QA person, which I was for about a year, what you actually get to see is the entire system, because you have to understand all of it, you have to test all of it, and you have to make all of it work. Mm-hmm. So in my mind, and I've seen this at Transmeta, some of the best engineers do come out of QA because they have a holistic grasp of the entire product. And it helped me, again, for the rest of my time at Transmeta, to really be, I hope, profoundly impactful in the entire product, because I understood all of it. And I also understood what the shortcomings were.
Mm-hmm. At this time, you mentioned also that Transmeta was still in stealth mode. Does that mean you don't know
Yes.
what the company is doing when you are joining it? Or do you have
Yes.
some idea?
Absolutely. When I had my interview there, I had no idea what they were doing. I was hoping they would do something with Linux. Again, 98, which I thought was had the next revolution potential, at least. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with Linus being there, and a couple of other Linux icons, you would assume that was the case. But no, on the first day of the interview, they told me they were doing a microprocessor. Okay, and I'm like, oh my God, okay. First of all, I'm not a microprocessor guy. And secondly, competing with Intel seemed ambitious, to say at least. Mm-hmm. But they had such a fascinating approach to it that it just became a fascinating intellectual challenge. And so regardless, I had to join them. The team, the place, the technology, and obviously the potential was just too seductive.
When were the low-power programs discovered within Transmeta? Or was it the goal? Actually, let me ask you before you answer that question. Was it the goal to find the low-power programs at Transmeta, or was it a byproduct of something else that was happening?
No, the original goal of Transmeta, which is little known because by the time the company uncloaked and came out of stealth mode, it was positioned as a low power company. But the original goal of Transmeta was actually to build a high performance microprocessor. And the way they set about it, though, already laid the right routes to adjust the direction. Because the thinking was, we will emulate a lot of the microprocessor functionality in software. Today, by the way, that's called virtualization or hypervisors. So it was an embedded hypervisor on a custom piece of silicon, which back then was a VLIW. That's a very long word instruction architecture, a very novel microprocessor architecture. So the whole idea was we will build a very lean piece of hardware, which of course will run very fast, right? And we will then put a piece of software on top of it to just optimally control it in an adaptive and in a very smart way. And unfortunately, what turned out to be the case when the silicon came back and we ran software on it, we ran Windows on it, it turned out that it wasn't as fast as we had hoped because the software overhead in the end was non-negligible. And so I guess the high performance CPU dream sort of went out the door at that point, but it was still a very, very lean and efficient architecture. And you know, efficiency can go into two directions. It can go into high performance, or it can go into high density or low power or energy efficiency. And so we changed direction towards energy efficiency at that point.
Yeah, when was this? Was it in like 99?
It was about 99. That's exactly
And
right. Yep.
moved to low power program. And what was the, there was no smartphone at that time, right? So
Oh
what
no.
was the use case of low power? Like, yes, we can do this, but who's going to use it?
Yeah, so it did become pretty clear that if internet connectivity would become pervasive, that you would want an all-day battery life, basically, in order to be really to get the freedom to do your work. When you wanted it and where you wanted it. And today this seems obvious and trivial, but in 99 we had I'll just give you an example. We had for instance Dell notebooks that were called Inspiron. We joked about them. We called them the USS Inspiron, which had 120 watt CPUs that lasted for less than 2 hours. I mean, today this is inconceivable, right? No one would buy this. But that was the treadmill that the industry was on, okay? Higher and higher performance notebooks with really pretty bad battery life that were just not ready at any level for the kind of internet revolution again, and giving you the freedom to really again work and where you wanted. And so that was the insight we had. We had it's like, look, these devices are going to be everywhere, and you really want to be able to use them everywhere and anytime. And we wanted to build, we changed direction to build the CPU to allow that.
I see. So you built a low power microprocessor. We accidentally, which was in early 99s, and then you got a customer who signed up to implement them, which was IBM. What happened when you
Yes.
first installed the product at IBM?
So it wasn't only IBM. I will say, especially the folks who were really ahead on this, and I would say culturally a little bit as well, they're the Japanese. So Sony, Toshiba, NEC, Fujitsu, pretty much any Japanese vendor was very, very interested in the CPU because in Japan, it's all about space constraint, really having a minimal footprint. And then, of course, the corresponding, like, we need to be able to take this wherever we can or are kind of attitude. So they're very, very successful there. And then IBM here, of course, in the early days also realized that for their low-end X series, that was a CPU that could give them pretty unprecedented freedom. I will just say, unfortunately, Intel by that time also had woken up. You know, if you compete with Intel, I will say you have your work cut out. And they certainly didn't make it easy with IBM. So ultimately, we lost IBM over this. But we did go to market with Sony, I think NEC back then, Fujitsu, and Toshiba. There, obviously, Intel had less influence or influence, I think is the right word, than over the North American PC manufacturers.
I see. So you were mentioning those later wins in the 2000s, which is the Sony design and the high revenues. But before that, I was referring to the long boot times that your processor had when you
Oh,
first implemented it. Can you talk to us about that?
No, I mean, again, that goes back to we were wanted to build this CPU that was like 10 times faster than what you could buy from Intel back then. And then the first version came back, we put it in an IBM notebook, and it took 30 minutes to boot Windows. And at that point, I think the conclusion was pretty clear that maybe the high performance story is not the one to pursue. And now, look, I will say that I was about employee number 20 in the company, so I had a little less invested less intellectual capital in the high performance story than some of the very early guys and the founders. But again, I think I could say, and you see this in my reaction to the internet as well, I probably have a reasonably good instinct what you can do with the technology. And I figured, wow, yes, the performance story isn't going to work out, but the power consumption in this super efficient and lean architecture is very, very low. So why don't we pursue that vector? And there were a couple of guys with me there. So we were a little bit of a renegade group within the company, made that happen, and it sort of I would say accelerated from there very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's hard to take on that role though, especially against the founders and the early executives. How do you manage to first of all take the stance and then succeed at it? Succeed at it, I must say. I mean, maybe the market kind of helped and it was obvious, but how was it taking that stance within the company?
Well, look, I mean, it was pretty clear. You know what you could do back then? You could say, look, you have on one hand your 100-watt Intel CPU that gives you, I don't know, whatever, 2 hours, whatever it was, of battery life, or and you can do this very analytically, very easy, okay? Or you have your 1 watt. Literally, we had a 1 watt CPU, okay? You have your 1 watt, 1 volt transmitter CPU, and that gives you 8 hours of battery life, okay? And wouldn't that be interesting for a number of use cases? And even though it was very early back then, the story and the potential was appealing enough that we could convince the leadership of the company to follow us. And I guess again, that goes all back to the kind of entrepreneurial approach or the entrepreneurial genes, where this is you kind of have to have a little bit of contrarian mind, I suppose, right? And so that was a perfect opportunity for a contrarian mind to make an impact, okay? And then you just have and that basically what you did back then.
Yeah, you went with the facts and reason, and it's so hard to do that.
Exactly.
It sounds easy to say, but it's hard to do when you're within it. So you had like a
Yes.
Sony design win, which was 10 million plus, and you were doing very well in through 2000s, right?
Yes.
So what was the revenue in 2000s? 2000, the year 2000.
That's a tricky question. I actually, frankly, don't quite remember. I think it was a couple of dozen of million. 20, 40 million, I seem to remember, but I'm really not sure anymore, to
So
be honest.
let me pull the number here. I have it. It was 16 million in 2000 and 36 million in 2001, which is a very fast growth. And at this time, you were having a lot of, you were beating Intel at many of the RFPs with your customers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had a unique product. Absolutely.
Right, so this time you are very, very fast growing, very successful
Yes.
with your customers. Tell us about the fights, or what is it called, the spy stories that had happened with Intel around this time. Tell us about the dumpster diving and
Oh yeah.
guys being arrested at the airport.
Yeah, so I think at some point we really got Intel's attention. That happened around the time when we launched the company, and they realized we did have a very different take on microprocessors and a very different strategy and a very different architecture that had the potential to really disrupt one of the key markets, the notebook market, right? So we got their attention, and as always, it's a blessing and a curse to have the attention of a very large and successful competitor. Intel is a formidable competitor, and I mean that with all, absolutely all admiration and respect. Now they, for their lives, couldn't figure out how we did that and what we did exactly. And so They tried, as far as we can tell, a lot of approaches to get more insight. And one of them was exactly what you said, the dumpster diving approach. We had literally trucks pulling up in the middle of the night and basically taking away our garbage to figure out probably to find material or any kind of information to figure out in more detail how we were going about this microprocessor. It's easy to adjust to that. We just, basically shredded all the material and made sure that nothing in clear text or in any kind of readable form left the company. But it was hilarious times. I will say this: it was quite intense. Exciting and exhilarating.
You do open up the processor and try to reverse engineer, kind of, right? Your competitor's product, like every company. Does that, but Intel, even in spite of opening your product up and all, they probably couldn't figure out, and that's why they were trying to do what they were trying to do.
Yeah, because the product was so different, right? Yeah. Intel was used to build microprocessors that were purely based on hardware, and yes, you can sort of reverse engineer them with traditional silicon methods. You can X-ray them. There's companies who specialize in that, okay? But that would not give you the secret sauce. The secret sauce was the software. And the software said encrypted on a ROM, and we made very sure that no one could decrypt it, okay? So it was not easily, at least, for a long time, it was just not possible to really get to the software code, and that ultimately was the big differentiator. So the architecture was so different and so disruptive that I think all established competitive intelligence means just failed, for them back then.
So at this, by this time, company already went public, and there's a lot of exuberance around Transmeta, and you moved on, right? But you had a later involvement with Transmeta in 2006 and 2007.
That's right.
Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, so we created, and my team created a lot of the low power IP for Transmeta, and again, I'll just contrast this. Intel launched what they called back then QuickStep, if I recall correctly, which was a somewhat first-generation simplistic approach to sort of manage somewhat CPU power. And what they did is they simply changed the frequency of the CPU when you were plugged in into power versus when you were just on battery, okay? Transmeta did this completely dynamically, only based on the actual application profile, which we automatically determined that was running on the system. So I would say we sort of took it two steps further and were so superior that obviously, again, Intel tried everything to figure out how we did that, okay? Well, it turned out that they actually, one way or another, they had figured out how we went about it, and they implemented their own version of it. And their own version was violating our IP and our patents. And so Transmeta in 2007, when our patents did, the important ones had all issued, a lot of them with my name, they went ahead and then they sued Intel. And because I had helped at least to create a lot of that IP, they retained me as a technical and a strategic advisor in that lawsuit. And so we sued Intel over IP infringement of the Transmeta, predominantly the low power technology.
Yeah, and it never went to the trial, right? It was settled.
Yeah. Intel settled it out of court for $250 million in I think 2007 or early 2007, I think.
Yeah. So you worked in Transmeta and in the Silicon Valley for a long time, and then you relocated to Germany in 2005. Or 2006, mm-hmm. right? How was the entrepreneurial scene in Germany? How was it at that time?
So the Silicon Valley is the place to be if you're in IT. I sometimes jokingly say, like, in the Roman Empire, the place to be was in Rome. In the IT industry, the places to be in the Silicon Valley, right? That's where the action is.
Yeah.
But, being from Germany, being an immigrant and all that, at some point, you do miss the place where you grew up a little bit as well. And so I figured, I'll make one attempt to see if I can build a successful company there as well, sort of, take the best of both, little personal reasons and business reasons. And I liked Zynga a lot back then because they had a very analytical approach to and very scalable approach to game playing and wrapped it in a very scalable business model. And there was no equivalent to that in Germany or in Europe. So we founded an online gaming company, social gaming company, where we put a lot of analytics in the back end to sort of really optimize all the games based on user pattern. And we did that in Berlin. And Berlin back then was on the early leg, on the first iteration of becoming one of the startup capitals in Europe. I think it's now pretty obvious that there's a lot of interesting things going on in Berlin. Again, back then it was 10 years ago, it was early days, but you could already feel the energy and the excitement and the capital inflow back then that are the important foundations to actually build a healthy startup ecosystem.
So you were saying it wasn't there or it was there? I'm sorry, I missed.
It was early. It was fledgling. It was nascent. Ah, okay. It was emerging. Okay. Very specifically, what tremendously helped back then was Hasso Plattner, one of the founders of SAP, had just started his venture fund HPI, Hasso Plattner Investments, just outside of Berlin in Potsdam, which is just barely outside of Berlin. And that kind of really fostered, that really sort of launched, I would say, or helped, significantly helped launching this startup ecosystem. So it was early days, but you could tell something significant was going on there, right? Similar to, you know, TCP IP in the 90s to Linux maybe in 95, in 2006, there, you could just tell the right ingredients for something interesting to be happening were there.
We usually talk about what, you know, people outside can learn from Bay Area, right? But I'm curious to hear from you what you think Bay Area founders can learn from, like, the startup ecosystem in Germany, because you've been in both places.
Okay, let me maybe start by saying what the German startup ecosystem could learn from the Bay Area, and then I'll turn it around as well, because really there's a little bit of best of both worlds. What I learned in Europe versus startups here is that in Europe, fundamentally, the exit markets are significantly smaller than they are here in the US, specifically in Silicon Valley. So the capital upside is just much more constrained, or the exit upside is much more constrained. And that shapes the thought model, the thought process about startups much more fundamentally than I had actually realized at the time. Because while tier one investors here focus on the upside of startups and they want to build something that is meaningful and that has a lot of potential because they have the exit markets to get their money back, even if it's a lot of money, in Germany, fundamentally, investors are focused on risk because the upside is just not that great, but you still have the same downside. So what do? You manage risk, okay? Yeah. So that's a very different approach to do startups than over here. And ultimately, I would say, you know, if you're used to how it's done here, at least back then, it might be changing now. I'm not sure. I've really not been there for a while. But at least back then, it was a lot more constrained. So I think what the Europeans and the Germans could learn, although, again, limited exit markets are certainly a problem there, is maybe obsessing a little less about risk and focusing a little more on upside and global thinking. Okay. Conversely, of course, since they focus a lot on risk, they also focus on pretty precise execution, right? Maybe that's something that's a little near and dear to the hearts of people there in the first place. And I say this with a certain level of self-awareness and criticism. But I do think that's something that folks could learn here. Maybe more precise, more focused, more targeted execution. You know, among all the incredible upside, of course, that's certainly here.
It's like an intrinsic controversy, right? So if you are selling a big enough vision, you have to be flamboyant enough about it. And if someone is as flamboyant about it, can the same person really focus on execution as much? So it's like a contradicting, like it's a hard thing to do. You have to focus on both sides.
It's very, very true. It's almost a bit of contradiction. Yes. Yeah. And I would say as an entrepreneur, striking the balance here, even in sort of balancing out your own personality, it's not easy. That's exactly right. Because yes, you have to be flamboyant and you have to be a little bit exuberant. And obviously you have to be very optimistic by nature, right? And sort of think about the big picture, and then how do you balance this well with like being reasonably detail oriented and focusing on execution? And sincerely, it's not an easy balance to strike. And I'm not, you know, I mean, I'm certainly adjusting, even now, you know, occasionally.
Yeah. Yeah. This must be a challenge that you're facing daily. So tell us about what you're doing now and what are your plans for the future?
Yeah. So, look, the big opportunity again, of course, you know, when I looked I'm going to draw a very big circle here. When I realized the potential of the internet back there in the early 90s, I also thought, look, then distributed systems, are going to be the wave of the future. And I came to HP Labs to do that, right? Not to only explore TCP IP and Unix, but to also explore distributed systems. And they have been, again, a fantastic, fantastic place to do this and to learn about this. And here we are, quite a bit of time later. And guess what? The Googles, Amazons, Azures of this world, what have they done? They have developed a software approach that they call hyperscale or web scale. And that's basically massively distributed systems that allow you to take commodity hardware, Taiwan Inc., so to speak, and disrupt the data center with it, because it allows you an unprecedented economic and an unprecedented operational efficiency. So now the name of the game is, how do you take this kind of approach to building systems, hyperscale or web scale or truly distributed, fully distributed, and you drive it into the enterprise segment by segment? And when we started this company, Datera, we felt that one of the areas that were open for grabs there, that they're underserved, was to take hyperscale to how data is stored, data is managed, data is orchestrated, and data is delivered. Build the data infrastructure for the data era. And that's exactly where the name Datera came from, the era of data, data era, Datera. Okay? So that's the approach. One other approach I would say, and I'll tie it back to Transmeta because it's so fascinating how some technology patterns work. Again, if you have a very efficient architecture, like we had at Transmeta, you could either play it in high performance because guess what? It's efficient, so it's probably fast, or you could play it as low power because it's efficient, so it probably doesn't consume a lot of energy, okay? What we do here, at least on the data plane, is actually similar in an abstract sense. We have a data plane that is very, very efficient. It has what's called very low latencies, very low overhead, okay? Now, you can play this very high performance, which we can, or you can play it very high density, which is industry-leading cost efficiency. And so that's one of our key value propositions. It's really great cost efficiency. At the same time, of course, coupled with what we hope, game-changing automation, because once you sort of have a frictionless data plane, i.e. you can move data around with very little friction, very efficient, very fast, high density, then it becomes all orchestration. You need to be smart about it. You need to know when and where it needs to be and how to best deliver it. And that's where we feel like this intelligent kind of system, that's where we place a lot of value on.
I see. So what stage is Datera in right now?
We are shipping product for about a year. We have a number of customers in production. We are ramping revenue. We have launched the company, i.e. came out of stealth mode in April this year. So that's about 8 months ago now. And we are about to release actually any day now, literally any day. We had a meeting this morning to that end. The second version of our product, which is obviously going to be a huge step forward, especially in the intelligent, in the self-optimizing, the self-driving, so to speak, the self-driving capabilities of the system, which you need to orchestrate all these, you know, dozens or hundreds of systems in a hyperscale data center.
So what is next for you, Mark, and Datera as a company?
My personal satisfaction has always been to build something meaningful. I think that Datera, if we play our cards wisely, if we execute well, if we continue on the current trajectory, Transmeta can be something meaningful. I'm excited. We are in a spot where basically the IT industry is fundamentally changing. We are very well positioned to take one of the slices out of that change and out of that changing infrastructure and hopefully be very significant or perhaps even dominant in it. And that's, to me, the future of Datera. Now, we have a way to go to get there, but it's exciting to be there in the early enough to have that opportunity.
So what advice, Mark, do you have for others who are just starting out in the tech space?
I would say most importantly pick an important enough problem to solve, a difficult enough problem to solve, that you get involved in something meaningful. Mm-hmm. And that requires, ironically, that's kind of what I'm looking in a lot of the candidates, that requires an interesting sort of taste, an interesting sort of sensitivity for sort of what are the tectonic plates, so to speak, in technology, and how are they evolving, and what does that mean in terms of where the interesting problems can be. And then it doesn't matter in what kind of company or in what role you get involved, because if you get involved in someone or with something that is foundational, that is creating foundational value, that is doing something meaningful, you will be successful on almost any number of levels. Obviously, the company, likely, if it's well managed, will be successful because there will be a lot of value. But I think also what's very important, you will be personally successful because you'll get the satisfaction of doing interesting work that has significant impact. And personally, you know, that's maybe even more important ultimately than, you know, necessarily the monetary value you put on it. So that's to me, that's the number one thing, really. Look for interesting problems and for people who solve interesting problems and try to sort of affiliate yourself with them.
Yeah. What do you think should come first? I've heard the people say both ways, whether the drive to, you know, start something on your own or do something big, or the drive to find something meaningful and as a result of that doing on your own. Like, what should come first in your opinion?
I don't know. I wouldn't judge one versus the other. Okay. I will say, going back to when I came over here, I started in large companies, first at HP, and then I did two other startups as an employee. In hindsight, I would actually say I should have just started my next company, period. Okay. Uh-huh. Because I'm that kind of guy.
Yeah.
But everyone is different, right? And so while for some people the right thing to do is they have enough drive and they have enough taste, they have enough talent, okay, I think these are the three ingredients. Taste, you got to pick an interesting problem. Talent, you actually need to be able to solve it. And drive, you actually need to be hanging there until it's solved, okay? So maybe they can just jump into the entrepreneurial game upfront, which is not an easy one. Or, you know, even, you know, the learning experience, again, being involved with the right people at the right place can be invaluable as well. I mean, you look at some of the very successful entrepreneurs. Of course, some of them, the most successful, they're so good, they just never work for anyone. But there's plenty of other people that come out of successful companies like Microsoft or Google or eBay, PayPal. Look at all these guys and what successful careers they've built afterwards, because they've been at the right place at the right time and learned how to solve problems, new problems, find and solve them in an interesting way.
Yeah, taste, talent, and drive. I like how you summarized it. I'm going to put it in the notes as well. Is there any question that I should have asked that I didn't ask you?
Yeah, so maybe I'll go back to what we currently do. I'd love to talk a little bit about Datera as well and what's so fundamentally different about us.
Yes, absolutely. Tell us about it. What is fundamentally different about Datera?
All right. Let me describe it with an analogy and say the big hype right now is the self-driving car. So because that's intuitively pretty graspable and people understand how revolutionary that is, I'll just use that as an analogy for the kind of infrastructure that we're building in storage or data management. And frankly, other people are building in other areas of the data center. So let's look at how a self-driving car really operates, right? You don't think about anymore you know, the steering or the gears or, you know, the traffic around you or, you know, filling it up with gas or maybe getting it charged up. You don't think about that anymore so much. The only thing you think about is your intent. What is my intent? Where do I want to go? What is my goal? Okay. And then you basically tell the car, you go figure it out. You go figure out all the details. Okay. And so that's basically the kind of infrastructure we're building. We capture application intent. We actually do call this intent, which is fundamentally what kind of requirements, service requirements do the applications have. And we communicate that to, in our case, to our storage infrastructure, data infrastructure. And everything else happens completely automatic, self-driving, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Okay? And not only...
So if I'm an application builder, traditionally I would have to figure out how to get a picture from the database. I would have to figure out how to get a command from the database. All these things that are needed to run my application, I would have to figure out. But what I can do in case of Datara is I can just use Datara's system and Datara will figure all that out. And I just need to plug into Datara's, so like an engine. Is that
yep.
the correct
so
way to put
speak.
It? Okay.
And to be a little more concrete now, you still need to build the application.
Yeah.
We assume the application is built.
Yeah.
Where we get involved is when you want to run it. Okay. And so traditionally, you still then have to figure out, oh, okay, we are involved with data management and storage, so that's our slice of the problem, right? Then you need to figure out, okay, maybe I need high-performance storage or low-performance storage, or I need expensive or not, or maybe I need partially expensive, partially not expensive. Where does it need to be? How reliable does it need to be? What are my snapshot policies? You know, all these attributes that you have in terms of you want this out of the infrastructure, it's the operation side. It's not the developer side, okay? Mm-hmm. And then, frankly, also, how does that evolve over time? Because that could be different if you're in development, while you're developing the applications, while you're testing it, while you're deploying it in production. It could change over time, right?
Yeah.
We take all of that burden off of you. You just tell us at a high level, what are the intents? What are the requirements? And we do all the hard work to deliver on those completely automatically, okay? Mm-hmm. So what that allows is that it frees... you, the developer, or the operator, it frees you up from the profane tasks of, you know, how to deal with the hardware itself, how to deal with failures, how to deal with all these little details. It frees you up and it lets you focus on business goals. And ultimately, that's exactly the insight and the big change in model that the Googles, Azures, and Amazons have done here. They've built similar systems. And you know that basically they run almost autonomically, right? And that's how they get to scale. And again, that's the recipe how infrastructure of tomorrow, the future infrastructure, will be operated.
The plug-and-play model.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. On top of that, I would say you layer two more fascinating effects, right? One, which is a little different than the car. And not only look at this as a self-driving car, but you layer on top of this kind of the idea of a swarm. We don't manage a single node, which would be a single self-driving car. We manage a swarm of nodes, right? And so once you have many of those to play with, you can then make resource trade-offs. You can then balance resources across them. And again, you can do this in a smart way to, guess what, again, maximize utilization, you know, once you're very efficient and sort of minimize cost by doing that. So use swarm intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, because it's kind of all pretty automatic, you deliver this infrastructure automatic, you deliver it continuously, you take data management and you take storage, you take it from an appliance perspective or from a box perspective to a service perspective. So it's kind of, you know, hardware or data management as a service. So it really sort of flips the model of the data center upside down from, again, infrastructure-centric, box-centric, hardware-centric, to service center.
Do you have to custom build based for every application based on the requirement?
See, in the old days, what you would do is you would build hardware or at least buy hardware, select hardware based on the application. That's exactly right. Let's say you wanted to run an Oracle database, you would buy a very high-end array. If you wanted to run a little scale-out big data application, you would buy a lot of, you know, maybe small servers, okay? What you would do with us is you describe these requirements in a file, literally declarative labels. You describe them in the file, those are the intents, and you send that file through an API to the infrastructure, and the infrastructure will assemble the resources out of the available resources, okay, to give you exactly those kind of needs. It's a very, very different way to operate infrastructure.
Yeah, for the infrastructure, for everything to be, if I send a file through the API and for all the resources to be assembled and given to me, that action,
yes,
for Datera's system to do that action, it has to be custom built for every application, or once built, it works for every,
yes,
application.
But in software, right? The trick is,
okay,
we do this in software, by software, just in time, precisely to your needs. Yes, we custom build, we tailor, we fit the resources precisely to each application, and then we ensure that it's continuously delivered to that application.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you want to run 100 of those applications, you basically say, okay, now give this to me 100 times. Go figure it out.
Yeah.
I mean, and then assuming you have enough hardware there to start with, right, it will do it automatically.
And that is the first step. And the second step is, again, you are doing this activity for 100 others. So you're talking about trade-offs. And the last one you mentioned, I believe, is... what is the last one you mentioned? Sorry, you mentioned three different aspects of it. Oh, yeah. Giving it as a service. Rather
exactly.
Now that you have these hundreds of people who are running different applications, you're doing trade-offs, you can as well go to the model of managing the data and the storage for these other 100 applications.
Exactly. And so, see, if you are a developer who grows up today, and you know you have an experience like Amazon or, again, Azure or Google, you can like use your credit card and you pay a couple of bucks and you get your resources almost instantly, self-service, right? Contrast that to how most data centers or how most enterprises are still operated, which is you file a ticket, and if you're lucky, you might get what you need in a couple of months, right? In the worst case, right? Clearly, you know, this model, they can't keep up with an Amazon or an Azure or a Google kind of style of self-service operating infrastructure. And so what we give people, we give them only for the storage side, for the data management side, we give them that kind of infrastructure for every data center that's out there. Okay. So we can help people building these self-driving, self-service, self-service data centers for enterprises or tier two service providers or for everyone else who wants to basically build a cloud.
Yeah, exciting stuff. So thanks for explaining that. Is there anything else I didn't ask you that I should have asked you about?
Nope.
I'm glad I asked you that question. Actually, most of my guests say nothing, but I do it for the one person who actually does comment something. So if someone listening to us wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to connect with you online, Mark?
Yeah, so obviously very easy. Send me an email, MWF, F like Frank, at Datera, Datera.io, or just Google me, Mark Fleischmann. It's easy to get in touch with me. It's hard to miss me.
but you have to spell Fleischmann correctly, so I'll leave your name in the show notes as well.
All right.
So, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Rohit, thank you very, very much for having me. It's been a total pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.